Hello viewers, welcome to Tat Capital's podcast. We have Vivek Goyal, one of the co-founders of PlaySifu, with us. So PlaySifu, in very simple terms, it's an interesting education technology company where they use as a digital technology company where they provide a combination of hardware tools along with the software which allows young children to interact with a whole bunch of gamified solutions to learn mathematics, physics, chemistry, and many other basic educational tools that you are generally taught in a school environment. But here, these young children are able to learn same outcomes that they would potentially learn in a traditional school, but in a gamified manner. So to that effect, it gives me immense pleasure to have Vivek with us today. Vivek, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Ram. Love to be here.
Thank you, Vivek, for being part of this. So Vivek, and thank you for agreeing to be part of the upcoming webinar where we're going to be talking to the topic of India, can it emerge to be a global deep tech player, a force in the deep tech industry? So to that effect, Vivek, maybe if you could just help our listeners to explain your journey till date and what led you and your co-founders to create PlaySifu.
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having us here. The PlaySifu journey is an interesting journey. We started off 3.5 to 4 years ago, based out of Bangalore in India. Before that, Dinesh and I, we have been friends for more than 15 years. We did our undergrad together from IIT Kharagpur. We spent some time in industry. Then I did my MBA from Stanford and spent a couple of years in the Valley doing a startup there and working with eBay to launch one of their new products. Since we got started at PlaySifu, the core fundamental problem that we were solving was, early learning per se between the age group of 3 to 10 has been a space where innovation hasn't really happened in many decades. Kids in this age group primarily learn through play. They learn through toys. They learn through, playing with friends outside, through group play, through craft. That's where they learn everything. And there are roughly around 20 foundational skills that kids have to navigate and learn in the age group of 3 to 10. But if you see education post 10, it has transformed a lot with the advent of tablets and computers in the life of kids. But early on, the toys still remain the same. And that's where we felt, kids who are attracted to screens these days, toys are not doing justice. And toys are so important for their motor skills development and early learning on development that we believe that there is a space here. There's something has to be done there. And based on our own kids, I have a 4-year-old, Dinesh has a 7-year-old. So this is something that personally we wanted to develop ourselves and then see whether there's a demand. Thankfully, kids in the age group of 3 to 11 behave and learn the same things worldwide. That's what led to a global appeal of whatever we were doing. So that's how we got started. The first things that we did was, how do we create experiences which did not involve technology hardwares in our product itself? Because hardware and technology were already present in kids' life through the tablets and the phones. We wanted to leverage what they had already and create experiences out of that. And that's where our foray into augmented reality started. And we built our own tech stacks based out of India to create these experiences.
Excellent. Vivek, if you could help the listeners to understand the deep tech component of PlaySifu and its products. What is the deep tech component in PlaySifu that really differentiates itself from your competitors, so to speak? And who are the current customers? I understand it, your core customer base is kids. But in your case, I understand that you reach out to the global children globally through various channel partnerships that you've established in a very clever way. So if you could go through both scenarios for us, please.
Sure. So talking about the deep tech component, so for us, the challenge was kids in the Gen Alpha kids, specifically the kids who are in the age group of between 3 to 11, they have a lot of device access. Specifically, if you see developed market, there is pretty much one device in every household. There is a device partially dedicated to kids in the schools. So they have access to device, but these devices are not the latest gen devices. These are generally either economical and budget devices, or they are passed down generation devices, which meant that if we had to create cutting edge augmented reality experiences to have a perfect seamless merge between the physical and the digital experiences, we had to work on these old generation processors, graphic processors, RAM, and that was the biggest technological challenge that we had. So we created our own vision stack, which used the front camera of devices and the back camera of devices. And we created a stack in a manner where it was super lean and it worked on very old gen devices like 2013 devices. And we could render 3D augmented reality content, which is animated for kids on any kind of old device, whether it's a 2013 iPad or in 1 GB RAM Android device like Samsung or Lenovo from 2014. So that is the biggest technological challenge that we overcame, because that meant we were ready for widespread distribution and widespread adoption in the consumer base. But beyond that, over the last 2 years, we have built multiple technology stacks that has helped us give far superior AR experiences. We have now started working on the voice-enabled stack. We are working on a touch stack, which is giving unique physical interaction on top of touch screens. So now the tech stacks are so diverse, as well as the data stack that we have built, which predicts users and which predicts user experience that is going to happen for kids post 3 days, 4 days. All of this combined is empowering an experience for kids in the play, which they never experience, right? 3 days after playing with something, if that thing already understands how kids are playing with it and what their interests are and customizes itself, that is something that kids have not experienced in the last decade. That is what it is driving big time adoption with us.
Sorry, quick question there. Can you explain to the listeners the learning component that kids actually get out of these games that they potentially play on PlayShifu's platform? So where does the learning, what are the learning outcomes that you are aiming for? Or are they measurable learning outcomes that the parents can actually see when kids are actually playing a particular game on PlayShifu's ecosystem?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we have to be cognizant about is the age group between 3 to 11 is not an age group which typically gives tests and, you know, scores. And, you know, you can grade them on how good they are in, you know, multiplication and tables and equations. It is an age group where they're learning about the fundamentals of pretty much everything in the world, whether it's nature or biology or body or mathematics. They're learning the fundamentals of everything. But to what we are making, everything that we make is a skill-oriented toy. We don't make mindless fun toys. We make experiences which are based on a particular skill. For example, so far we have released around 12 different skills products, be it geography, general knowledge, foundation of engineering skills, mathematics, the basics of it, letters and alphabets and words, music. We have released something on that. So we take care of not only STEM skills, but we take care of all the skills that kids have to go through in this age group. And there are 20 and plus skills in this age group. And what we do is we gamify in the manner that the learning is in the backdrop of the gaming, while the gamification and the interactions and the digital interaction is in the forefront. And that's why kids don't feel like they're studying. They feel like they are actually playing a very normal game, which is animated and is changing constantly. But there's learning happening in the backdrop. So that's how we position our products. Now, to the measurable part of the question, yes, we have a parent app where kids can actually go and see what kids have been playing with, what they have seen so far. We also give them clues of, you know, go and talk to your kid about this, because they've seen this on our products, so they must actually understand this. So there's a conversation point for parent to go and check with their kids. So we try to crystallize and put up analytics and visualization of whatever we kids is learning on our app in a manner that parents can absorb. But it's not as formal as taking a quiz and giving them a percentage. So we stray on the side whether we believe their understanding is good or not with the time they're taking to solve challenges. And that's where we stay at.
Excellent. Vivek, I think you were about to answer the previous question and I intervened. So let's go back to that question. So given PlayShifu is such a young company and you have a global customer base today and a global footprint, so to speak, so what has been your experience of potentially winning a global department store or global customer in terms of accepting PlayShifu's product into their distribution ecosystem or in their marketplace or on their supermarket aisles, so to speak? I know that you exist in various parts of the world. And how have you actually explained your pitch, given I'm of a view that PlayShifu has a lot more inorganic growth rather than organic growth? I don't think PlayShifu has got its own storefront globally, but you actually use a significant distribution channels. So if you could give us a bit of an insight in terms of how has that ever journey kind of evolved?
Sure. You're absolutely correct. You know, we have taken a distribution channel based approach where we have partnered with very you know, very able-minded and right partners in various geographies. We are now present in around 15 different countries in a significant way. And we have a very good partner in most of these geographies. The markets that we're navigating ourselves are US, Canada, US and India. And everywhere else, we have a very good partner that has helped us. To your question, how were we able to get these partnerships? How were we able to penetrate the market with shelf space as well as online, you know, eyeballs? The question is answered in the two parts. The first one is, you know, the products themselves, as I talked about, the user need is global in nature, right? It's for example, social media, if you see Facebook, it was solving a need which was global in nature. Localization in terms of language was needed, but that's what made a truly global product. And that's where we also play, whether it is a six-year-old from Japan, six-year-old from Australia, six-year-old from UK or US or India. All of them are going through some stage of, you know, foundation of mathematics, be it, you know, counting a number or addition. They're in different stages, but they are still learning those through stories, through playing, through toys. Same happens with geography, right? They are learning about the world, about the animals, about the countries at the age group of 7 and 8 in various different manners, through videos, through gameplays, through video games. So those 20 skills that we're talking about are actually every kid goes through in one manner or the other. And literally, it means that they're either playing with their friends or they're reading books or they're playing digital games to actually go through and play those things. So for us to pitch why we are needed and what's the need was actually never a concern, because the right distributor we chose, they already started off, the conversation started off with the thing that we already understand the need in the market and we already understand the dearth of options that are there. So we love it. We just want a sample. We want to play with it for a couple of weeks. We ought to give it out to, you know, 10 of our parents, and we'll come back once we hear back. And typically, you know, what we have seen is 2 weeks later, they come back saying that, you know, everybody that we showed it to and the kids played with it, they were, you know, blown away with what we have created in terms of visual experiences and the learning angle of it. So our products themselves created the huge pull and the conversions that happened in most of these geographies. And that is why the resulting shelf space and the sell-through rate that we have on these is very high.
Thank you, Vivek. The next set of questions, we will focus on India for a moment. Right. Given our upcoming webinar is all about talking India's capability to emerge as a global deep tech player, stand out as a key contender, so to speak, the next set of globally scalable products, so to speak. So to that effect, what do you think that is actually currently happening in India, which is allowing deep tech to be really built out of India? I understand for a significant portion of last 2 to 3 decades that India has kind of made a couple of jumps. Once, first of all, being a services economy, trying to literally service the global technological needs. And then India has kind of pivoted to a whole bunch of B2C needs where India has provided a whole bunch of needs that a consumer needs. But I'm of the view today that India is actually not just providing a B2C product, but they're also providing a whole bunch of B2B products which are built on fundamental principles of deep technologies, which are integratable into various other things. So what's your take on India, and what's your view on the current deep tech talent in India?
No, absolutely. So, no, you are correct. You know, in terms of last 2 decades has seen a lot of technological advancements in India. And I think the deep roots lie in core engineering mindset, you know, the deep engineering mindset that stays as we grow up. You know, although it is not advisable to say, you know, when parents put pressure on kids that you have to be either, you know, a lawyer, an engineer or a doctor. But one of the side effects of that is that there are lots of engineers, and there are engineers in who are very solid in terms of foundation of maths and engineering, which has created a large pool of STEM-related field workforce that is enabling, you know, the Infosys of the worlds in the 90s and 2000s. But I believe the last 10 years, we have realized a potential where we started believing in ourselves, where we can create more value than just servicing the market, you know, creating more value-added products, originating original products, and doing more research-oriented products is what, you know, in the last 10 years has been really proven. And this has started off with a services segment, but then slowly moved on to more enterprise market, where we, you know, global enterprise products started getting created out of India. And now it is shifting more towards consumer products. Although consumer products, the demand is still India only, and there's a lot of consumer base in India to service to. But like us, we know a handful of companies who are now trying to make an attempt where consumer products are globally being served out of India, made in India and served out of India. So I believe those are the key factors. The other thing that has happened in the last 7 to 8 years is the overall economical environment and the government policies around favoring startups and things becoming easier for startups to register and pay taxes and comply with various things, a fundraise becoming easier from documentation perspective. These are the things that have helped raise more capital for the startups, which in turn has helped startups to scale more.
Excellent. Vivek, I think you kind of touched on my next question that I really wanted to ask. I think my next question was mainly around the information superhighways or the public infrastructure that kind of got really created by the Indian government over the last decade and a half. I believe credit should definitely go to both current government and the previous governments, given it was a continuum as opposed to a brainchild of one over the other. But structurally, I think India as a country has decided to create a public usable superhighway, so to speak, which allows anybody to jump into that ecosystem. Let it be, for example, the India stack that India has built. Let it be the real-time payment gateways that India has allowed to build. And many of those KYC-related stack that India's government has built. I think all of this, to an extent, I suppose, definitely has given many entrepreneurs like yourself to use those digital warehouses, so to speak, and digital infrastructure, which is more freely accessible. So what's your take on the current regulatory framework on helping companies like yourself to build commercially scalable products out of India, or a product that is actually appealing enough for a global investor base to be attracted into a country like India? What do you think are the key drivers that is really helping those global investors and global customers to look at India today?
Right. So I think, to your point, those infrastructure changes that India has done have absolutely made doing business in India and starting business in India much easier. And that's one of the bigger points why so many startups are coming up, right? Every state is now recognizing startup. There is a list of all the startups that are being recognized. There is a taxation ease that has happened if you are registered as a startup with Government of India. So all of those things have made it super easy for a startup to start in India and then scale. But specifically to the point that, the tech infrastructure that government is building around the startup, how is that specifically helping? I think that is specifically right now, it's helping a lot if you're building a product for the India market, because, for example, a lot of UPI-based stacks, which is making payments super easy off an app through a single click or a face scan, is something that is being used extensively now in India. And a lot of companies from outside, for example, WhatsApp is starting WhatsApp Pay through those methods. So that is changing the landscape in India. And I think over the next couple of years, 3 years, we'll start seeing these products going globally, because these are truly innovative systems which are not present outside, whether it's fintech or whether it's medtech, health tech. All of these are going to go outside from here, because the demand itself in India is so huge and it's going to grow from there. It's happening a lot more in some of the global industries. It's slowly going to progress in other industries also. But to your point, yes, the infrastructure is actually changing the landscape a lot.
So do you think, Vivek, the free information warehouses, so to speak, that is available, let it be your abilities to potentially do some sort of a qualitative survey at a very high-speed internet, or let it be access to a whole bunch of databases of all private and public schools, so to speak, and many other ways to interact with your key customer base, which could not have been possible probably a decade ago, but today it's possible. And to that extent, how is these various pockets of information warehouses, so to speak, potentially going to help for the deep tech sector to really evolve? I understand over the last decade, we have seen a lot of customer-facing transactional style technology companies have really taken advantage of this India stack, so to speak. But do you really think this general information technology stacks that Indian government has allowed to be built, but pretty much in a public-private partnership, will really help the deep tech environment really evolve? How will this help?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, if you look at specifically the verticals around AI and machine learning, those are the two verticals where the future lies. Whether those cut across every industry. Whether it's construction industry, healthcare, or edtech. those are the horizontal stacks that are going to transform the way each of these verticals and industries work. Now, what enables true leadership in these is availability of a lot of data. You know, until and unless engineers have that kind of data source available, they cannot play around with data. They cannot come up with fast, lean, mean algorithms that can actually process data in that manner and create those algos. So I completely agree. These data houses are going to be beneficial for the Indian engineer database for them to create value in the future. But it's going to be slow and it's going to take time over the course of next 2 to 5 years to be coming out with something that is going to meaningfully change the world.
Vivek, thank you very much for participating in our podcast today. We look forward to interacting with you in the upcoming webinar. And thank you again for your time today.
Thank you so much, Ram. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.